everyone who loves books. This is Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about books that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week we're taking a look at books and prisons. Journalist and convicted murderer Irwin James tells Robert how a Perkins brailer helped put him back on the straight and narrow.
Given an opportunity to provide such an amazing service for people, it's very humbling.
We hear about RNIB's involvement in a project to put books in the nick.
He said it was the first time he'd been given a book, and because of that, it's an amazing transformation in our relationship.
Emma Donoghue reveals how a real-life case of domestic imprisonment inspired her novel, Room.
You know, it happened to be hearing headlines about the Fritzl case in Austria that triggered it, but what I immediately jumped on was the notion of a small child relating his first encounter with a world that he didn't even really know was there.
And I unlock a hidden gem that became a dazzling film. That's all coming up in today's Read On Air. Irwin James is a convicted murderer who served 25 years in prison for his crimes. Towards the end of his sentence, he began writing for The Guardian, giving an insider's view of life in jail. Since being released on licence, he's gone on to write 4 books about his time behind bars and the use of prison to punish crimes. He told Robert Kirkwood about his latest book, Redeemable.
Well, it's a book, it's a hard account of how I became who I became, from the sort of earliest beginnings through a really challenging sort of life journey to disaster and failure, and then basically how I sort of crawled out of the deepest hole imaginable and managed to become, I think, who I should have been. I guess in a nutshell, that's what it's about.
You talked about prison libraries.
Well, prison libraries, Christ, you know, I was so grateful for prison libraries. But I was grateful that I could read. You know, so many people in prison, they can't read. I didn't know that. I didn't know when I went into prison that I had the edge on so many of my fellow prisoners just because I could read. And the prison library, they were lifesavers, prison library. In terms of books just to enjoy, but also books to make me think, books to educate myself. You know, I needed books. I was hungry for books all the time.
And you're still serving your sentence?
Well, I am, because I got a life sentence. I was convicted of murder, and I deservedly got a life sentence. But, you know, what happens is when you get a life sentence, you serve a term in custody, and then if you sort of behave and demonstrate that there's some change or some progress in your life and you're not going to be a risk to the public, eventually that you get a chance. You know, I'm so grateful that I live in a country prepared to give someone like me a second chance, but we give people second chances in this country, and I got my second chance after 20 years in jail.
We've recently on the show been talking to Irvin Welsh about his book Blade Artist. Have you heard about Blade Artist?
I've heard about it. I've not read it, yeah.
But Begbie becomes a reformed character in prison and becomes an artist. Do you think you are the sort of the real-life version of that fiction?
Well, sort of, because I was a pretty amoral character. I'm not going to lie to you. There's not, you know, I was so far away from civilized society, as you know, my criminal lifestyle was just appalling. It's absolutely appalling, and I couldn't imagine living like that now. That's the strange thing. When I was lived like that, I used to look at normal, look, nice people who lived in nice houses and think, how do you get to live in a house like that? How do you get to be a part of a community where you have a purpose and a meaning? And I didn't know how to do that. And yet now I live like that, and I don't know how I lived when I lived on the streets. I don't know how I managed that. I couldn't do it now.
And in prison, you did some Braille transcription.
Well, when I first went in, I mean, I'd had a job. They put me in an engineering workshop, but my job was just filing down lumps of metal. So I just sit all 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the afternoon, just filing lumps of metal. And we had to do these psychology tests, psychological assessments. And then an officer came to my cell door one day and he said, the tests that you've done show that you might have an aptitude for Braille transcription. They had this little Braille unit, you know. And I didn't know what Braille was. But I went and did a test. And then, you know, within a couple of weeks, I was doing this thing called the Braille Primer. You know what the primer is. And I worked through that, and it was the in prison. It was the best job I ever had. I used to, you have this little thing, this little Perkins Braille machine with six keys, and there was a dozen of us in this Braille unit, and people who couldn't see would send requests in for books or for things that they wanted to transcribe. And what I loved doing, one of my favourite things was doing, was when there was an image or a picture that needed description. So me as a writer, you know, because I don't forget, I didn't know I was a writer then, but I loved doing those. You know, narrative descriptions of images and pictures. But I loved that job. Even when I look back now, it's making me smile because I was in prison and I was paying my penance and trying to, you know, make some sense of it. And I was given an opportunity to provide such an amazing service for people. It's very humbling that I was doing this. I used to do a book a week sometimes, you know, to blast away like a madman on this Perkins machine. In fact, the 12 of us in this Braille unit were all doing long, long prison sentences. But all you could hear, all the bash, 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 and these keys going away. And it was a fantastic job, honestly. It was a pleasure to do that.
And we've got something in common. We've both transcribed the TV guide.
Yeah, a brilliant TV guide. And it was sometimes annoying when there wasn't much description of the programme. I think they need more than that. And I think I'm trying to add a little bit more colour to it so that people could understand what the programme was about. But
did you have a TV at the time in your cell while you were doing that?
My first 14 years, there was no TV. And then... In 1994, what was it, 1998, 1999, they brought televisions into prisons. And I'll be honest with you, I had mixed feelings about it because on the one hand, it took away the mental isolation of a prison cell. I could now, you know, project my mind and thoughts to a screen. And what, you know, trouble is I became addicted to Coronation Street. So, you know, you go to prison and even now I'm still a mad Coronation Street fan because I looked forward to that. You know, the banal normality of everyday life, which you don't get in prison. Prison's just one long challenging struggle to survive. But Coronation Street was always, because I remembered Coronation Street before I went to prison. So there was a civilized link there, but television, I like to read in prison, you see, and television in a way can make you a little bit lazy, but I was grateful to see the outside world through a television screen, if I'm honest.
Was that not a special kind of torture, though, making you do the TV guide when you couldn't watch the programmes yourself?
Well, in a way it was, because we had television rooms, so you watched you had association in the evenings until about 8 o'clock, so you could watch TV till 8 o'clock, but you never saw the late night programmes. You never saw the late news or programmes with a bit of a thriller or something like that. You never saw that sort of stuff. So it could be a bit frustrating. We think, I wish I could see that. But, you know, it was just a joy to do that work.
And you mentioned in your talk there was a riot within a riot when someone, during a riot, smashed the TV.
Yeah, nobody could believe it. What the hell did he smash the TV? Because now we're totally isolated from the outside world. We had one television on the wing. And somebody went and smashed it during the riot, but it was the least of my worries that night, I've got to tell you.
Now, you ended up, while still inside, being a Guardian columnist. How did that come about?
Well, just coincidences, you know. I met a probation officer whose next-door neighbour was a writer, and I used to read this writer's book. His name was Ronan Bennett. And when I told the probation officer, he suggested I write to Ronan, just a sort of fan letter sort of thing, you know, appreciating his work. And I did that. We ended up having a friendship. And then he knew somebody at The Guardian who they were talking about having a prisoner, a long-term prisoner. How do we get a long-term prisoner who can write for the newspaper to tell us what prison's like? And Ronan said, well, I know a guy. And so, you know, recommended me. Of course, then I had to do it. It's one thing... fantasizing about being a writer, a professional writer, when you can write a good letter, because I was the prisoner that could write a good letter. Then when the opportunity came and I had to sit and write 800 words, first of all every fortnight and then every week, and I had to bring in, you had to be interesting, you had to have colour, you had to have information, you had to be entertaining, you had to have some moral value, you know. And it was a hell of a challenge, I've got to tell you, but it took some discipline. The thing about writing is, It takes a lot of discipline writing. And of course, people would read my column in sort of 5 or 6 minutes, but it might take me all day to write it. Sometimes it took me 2 or 3 days to write that column, you know. And sometimes I'd look at the paper and think, I wish words would come. I couldn't think of anything to write about, you know. I was always hoping for a scandal or a riot or some sort of gossip. I used to ask my two pals, Big Rinty and Felix the Gambler, say, any scandal, any gossip? I need something for my column this week, you know. But, yeah, it was amazing, that was...
You also mentioned in vivid detail what your cell looked like on the first day that you arrived in prison. Is that sort of burned into your memory?
Oh, God, yeah. Well, my first book was called A Life Inside, and the jacket cover is just a bare cell with a bed and there's not even a table and a chair there in the image. And there's a cell high up on the back wall, and it looks exactly like my prison cell. But, I mean, I deserved to be there, but the thing was, it was pretty bleak and grim. It was just flaking emulsion paint, sort of light green stained flaky emulsion paint on the walls, with this small window on the back wall high up, with three sets of bars on the window, and a cot bed with a very very thin, very stained mattress, and half a sponge pillow, a table, chair and a bed, and a bucket for my toilet. That was it, you know. That was it.
Do you find now that when people find out about your background that they're intimidated ever so slightly by you?
Well, I hope not, because I don't find myself I'm not an intimidating person. I don't think I am anyway. But I mean, I've got quite a shocking past. So if people know me and don't know about my past, and then they find out about my past, it can be a bit awkward, because it's quite hard to reconcile the person that I present now with this person who, you know, I was a very violent criminal. There's no question about that. I was somebody who caused a lot of pain and distress to other people. And I think marrying those two images can be quite awkward for some people, you know. It's a bit awkward for me sometimes. I think, how did I live like that, you know? But I think coming to events like this and sort of sharing this experience, it helps an audience to understand, but it helps me as well. It gives me some validation and some sense that that this is really happened. This has been a journey, and it's worth me continuing this journey, you know.
Is your level of rehabilitation available for everyone who goes into prison, do you think?
Well, I got a lucky break with the writing, so I found a skill in prison. You know, I was never a writer; I wasn't educated. But then, because I was the guy that could write a good letter, and writing became something that I really enjoyed, I developed this skill. Even then, not thinking, "Oh, when I get out, I'm going to be a writer." Who would think that? I mean, prison serving life. You know, I wasn't thinking, "When I get out, I'm going to be a writer." I was just thinking, "Well, this is something I can do now, and it makes me feel that I'm doing something worthwhile." And then I got this lucky break with The Guardian. I got out of prison after 20 years. I was a Guardian columnist. I wrote features for Radio Times. I wrote features had a column in The Big Issue. You know, I was being accepted by the writing fraternity as a writer. Mm-hmm. And then I was getting paid, you know, good money for writing. I was making a living at writing. So I never saw that coming, you know. I never saw that coming.
Erwin James, thanks so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking me to talk to you.
Thanks to Robert and to Erwin James. A Life Inside, A Prisoner's Notebook, is available from the RNIB Library as TB 400358.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. To join, telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk. RNIB is a membership organisation. To join, visit rnib.org.uk/membership.
Hi, my name's Steve Hodson, and I've been reading for RNIB Talking Books for, 35 years. It's been difficult to choose a favourite book. You can imagine, in 35 years, I've done an awful lot. Novels, biographies, autobiographies, poetry, all sorts of things. From Russia with Love, A James Bond Adventure by Ian Fleming. Yubiyana mat! The gross obscenity was a favourite with General G. His hands slapped down on the desk. Comrade, there certainly is a man called Bond, as you put it. His voice was sarcastic. Shems Bond! and nobody, myself included, could think of this spy's name. We are indeed forgetful. No wonder the intelligence apparatus is under criticism. General Vozdvizhensky felt he should defend himself and his department. There are countless enemies of the Soviet Union, Comrade General, he protested. If I want their names, I send to the Central Index for them. Certainly I know the name of this Bond. He has been a great trouble to us at different times, but today my mind is full of other names, names of people who are causing us trouble today, this week. I am interested in football, but I cannot remember the name of every foreigner who has scored the goal against the Dynamos. You are pleased to joke, comrade, said General G, to underline this out-of-place comment. This is a serious matter. I, for one, admit my fault in not remembering the name of this notorious agent. Comrade Colonel Nikitin will no doubt refresh our memories further, but I recall that this Bond has at least twice frustrated the operation of Smersh. That is, he added, before I assumed control of the department. As I say, I've been doing this for 35 years now, and I just hope it carries on forever, even when my teeth have fallen out and I'm totally gaga. Even then, I'll have to be dragged kicking and screaming from the studios. I've loved doing it, particularly because we've had some wonderful responses. We all get them. One woman got in touch once, and she was quite late to talking books. But even then, a whole new world had opened up for her. And it was just so exciting to hear that, and makes it all worthwhile. Roberts asked if we could finally add a line to end this, written by him, but I'm going to say it from the bottom of my heart. Thanks for listening to Talking Books. It's been my pleasure.
You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come on today's show, Emma Donoghue reveals how she was captivated by A Case of Captivity, and I review the book of the film The Shawshank Redemption. But first, Steve Whitmore is passionate about books. The Special Constable has seen the difference that a paperback can make to those in custody at a police station. So, with the help of RNIB, he has launched a scheme to provide paperbacks for those in custody in police cells. He explained to RNIB Connect Radio's Alan Russell where the idea came from.
Here on RNIB Connect Radio, we always encourage people who have difficulty with reading, that could be through being registered blind or partially sighted, to look at things like talking books, looking at transcription of literature into large print and braille. Because let's face it, there's a huge use for literature, whether it's for leisure, education, employment. And today we're going to find out about a new way of using accessible books. And to tell us more, we have with us Steve Whitmore. Steve, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the programme.
So how does it work?
Yeah, well, we've changed the title since somewhat to call Books in the Nick. And it works by providing free books to detainees who are in police custody.
Okay, so these are being used in police stations. Now, when you say people are in custody, they haven't actually been charged with anything, so they've just perhaps arrived at the station?
Yeah, I mean, they'll have been arrested for an alleged offence and they'll be brought into the police station or the police custody suite, which I provide books for in the Metropolitan Police Service. And they will have been booked in and been put into a holding cell while their case has been investigated, and then they'll be given the opportunity to talk about that. But they won't have been charged with an offence at this point, and they'll be put into a holding cell where they could be detained for up to 24 hours, depending on the time of day and the nature of the alleged offence. So whilst they're there, the detainees, from ages from 12 and upwards, they don't have access to any computers, TV, radio, or their phone. There's nothing in the cell they can have access to other than reading material.
This is, you know, an innovative project, Steve. Where did the idea come from?
Yeah, so about a year ago, I'm a special constable working for the Metropolitan Police Service, so I'm a a volunteer police officer. I have a job outside of this, working in healthcare. And on one of my duties, I arrested a young man, just turned 18, for two offences. And when I booked him into Brixton Custody Suite, he asked me for a book. I said, not a problem. I went looking for a book, and there were no suitable books for him or material that he would like to read. So I gave him my book, which just happened to be a great classic, Catching the Rye. So he had this book, and he was overjoyed by having something to occupy his time whilst he was in the custody suite. And he said it was the first time he'd been given a book. And because of that, it was an amazing transformation in our relationship. There's an instant rapport. We could chat about something other than what he was there for. And he opened up to me, and we kind of formed a kind of a special bond there. And it made him more relaxed. His anxiety levels decreased. And he could not only have an opportunity to read a book, which he wanted to, but he could keep that book. And he could take it away with him. And I just thought, wow, if I can have this effect on one person, what must it be like if other police officers working for the NPS could have the same effect? And so I started up my initiative called Books in the Nick about a year ago.
This simple gesture, then, of providing a book has made a huge difference to this individual. So did you think then, you know, I can do a lot more with this, or where can I get all the books, and what will people like? There must have been a thousand questions in your head.
Yeah, most definitely. It was a very small idea that has since grown to be quite an incredible project that I've worked on, but it needed a lot of help and resources and the right sort of people to support me. And Give a Book, the charity that I work with, who provide all of the free books, they have been essential in sourcing the right type of material for this particular project, because people coming in can be held for, like I said, up to 24 hours, but some can be held for beyond that, or even for shorter periods of time. And if you give somebody a book that, say, is a really big read, they will think, whoa, how long am I going to be here for? Whereas if they have access to smaller books or quick reads, poetry, where we provide popular fiction, and all types of literature that they can access, but maybe for a shorter period of time, then they feel more comfortable and they relax visibly. And also, that relationship that they have with the police staff makes it a lot easier to be in that environment.
I mean, this could also be, I would think, as well as just the books as well, you know, information, because there's lots of magazines, bulletins, which people could read and maybe find something of interest to them as well. So it could be almost a step on a path for some people too.
Yeah, definitely. Within the books, and we provide the Connect magazine from the RNIB. There'll be a Braille book in each custody suit within the Met, and we're expanding that to more national police forces. Within each book, we place a bookmarker that advertises charities to enable people, particularly juveniles. We're trying to focus on getting away from knife crime and gangs and acid attacks, and charities that can be signposted towards helping them on a rehabilitation path. And, yeah, giving them access to free educational courses, local libraries. So it's definitely a stepping stone in the right direction. And we call it a teachable moment in the police cell. It's an opportunity for the person who's there to take stock of why they're there and perhaps have a better outcome and make more of a productive time.
Interesting you mentioned accessible literature as well, Steve, because, you know, many people may not think that someone going in may have poor sight, so, you know, they may need Braille, they may need large print.
Yeah.
Does that extend to audio, or are there issues there?
Everything's risk assessed on an individual basis. So the majority of people coming in to the custody suite would be like you or me. They've maybe been caught up in a situation they've got involved in. A lot of times people will be innocent, and it's just a very stressful and demanding time of their life. So people will be coming in, and we do provide magazines and books, like I said, Braille and large print, Barrington Stoke books. We are looking towards audio. We're looking towards technology and improving the services that we provide. And it's something that we are looking to maybe access at a later date, but it would be on an individual basis.
Now, you say you're looking to spread this, you know, across other forces. That then, to me, would say that this has been really well received by colleagues.
The project's only been running for just over 1 year. Every person I've spoken to in the Met has been really supportive of this and really want to make a difference, to reach out to people who are affected by crime and who are coming in. The door's always been open to me whenever I've gone to seek support and aid within the Met. And we have been contacted by other police forces, so we now provide books to eight other police national forces. and we are looking towards getting charitable status at the end of the year, and yeah, making it more sustainable. One of the ideas that I brought in is working with a lot more volunteers from the community, police cadet groups and police volunteers, to come together and to support this.
You're looking to have this recognised as a charity, Steve, but you're also using other charities to help grow this.
Yeah, most definitely. We are working in partnership. We have an official partner now, which I'm happy to say on air, is RNIB. They've since come towards us and working alongside to provide the Connect magazine and Braille books, which are brilliant, towards each police station within the Met. So by the end of the year, that's one of our main aims, is to have these type of resources within each custody suite. And looking towards the future, we're in talks with Prince's Trust and Barnardo's to have a national framework where we can assist young children as well.
The sky's the limit from such a simple idea, just giving someone something to read.
Yeah, most definitely. It's almost like a transaction of worth. You're recognising that person as an individual, and you're talking to them about something that is not related to why they're there, and it enables them to have a much more of a productive time, and that everybody's associated with it is really, really supportive.
Steve, just finally, if people would like to learn more about the project or maybe get involved, help out with fundraising, etc., is there a way they can do that?
So we're in the process of setting up a web page, but if they were to do an internet search for Give a Book, they would find the necessary information.
Steve, best of luck with Books in the Nick, and thank you for telling us all about it on RNIB Connect Radio.
Oh, I really appreciate that, Alan. Thank you very much.
What a great idea. Thanks to Alan and to Steve Whitmore. And don't forget, we're always keen to hear about the books that you're reading. Why not drop us a line via the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk, and share your love of the written word. You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, a tale of domestic imprisonment. But before that... This week's hidden gem is a novella by Stephen King. Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption is the first of four stories in a collection called Different Seasons that was first published in 1982. In 1994, it was adapted into the film The Shawshank Redemption, starring Tim Robbins and Morgan Freeman.
Andy came to Shawshank Prison in 1947.
Why'd you do it?
I didn't, since you ask.
You can fit right in.
I must admit, I didn't think much of Andy first time I laid eyes on him. He had a quiet way about him. A walk and a talk that just wasn't normal around here.
There are places in the world that aren't made out of stone. There's something inside they can't touch.
What are you talking about?
Hope.
It tells the story of Andy Dufresne, a banker who in 1948 is convicted of the double murder of his wife and her lover. Although he claims to be innocent, he has no choice but to adapt to his new life behind bars at Shawshank State Penitentiary. Having had the foresight to smuggle some money in with him, Andy is able to afford the services of the story's narrator, Red.
There is a guy like me in every state and federal prison in America, I guess. I'm the guy who can get it for you. Tailor-made cigarettes, a bag of reefer, if you're partial to that. A bottle of brandy to celebrate your son or daughter's high school graduation, or almost anything else, within reason, that is. It wasn't always that way. I came to Shawshank when I was just 20, and I'm one of the few people in our happy little family who is willing to own up to what he did. I committed murder. I put a large insurance policy on my wife, who was 3 years older than I was, and then I fixed the brakes of the Chevrolet Coupe her father had given us as a wedding present. It worked out exactly as I had planned, except I hadn't planned on her stopping to pick up the neighbor woman and the neighbor woman's infant son on the way down Castle Hill and into town. The brakes let go and the car crashed through the bushes at the edge of the town common, gathering speed. Bystanders said it must have been doing 50 or better when it hit the base of the Civil War statue and burst into flames. I also hadn't planned on getting caught, but caught I was. I got a season's pass into this place. Maine has no death penalty, but the district attorney saw to it that I was tried for all three deaths and given three life sentences to run one after the other. That fixed up any chance of parole I might have for a long, long time. The judge called what I had done a hideous, heinous crime, and it was. But it is also in the past now. You can look it up in the yellowing files of the Castle Rock Call, where the big headlines announcing my conviction look sort of funny and antique next to the news of Hitler and Mussolini and FDR's alphabet soup agencies. Have I rehabilitated myself, you ask? I don't know what that word means, at least as far as prisons and corrections go. I think it's a politician's word. It may have some other meaning, and it may be that I will have a chance to find out. But that is the future, something cons teach themselves not to think about.
A keen amateur geologist before he got locked up, Andy asked Red to get him a rock hammer so he can shape the pebbles he collects from the exercise yard into small sculptures. Later, he also asked Red for a large poster of the actress Rita Hayworth, which he sticks on his cell wall. Over the next 28 years, Andy replaces that poster with new ones of other pin-ups such as Raquel Welch and Marilyn Monroe. He tells Red he likes to imagine that he can step through the poster to join the girl in freedom. One day, Andy overhears a prison guard complaining about the amount of tax he'll need to pay on an inheritance. Andy tells the guard how he can legally shelter the sum from tax, and soon finds himself handling the financial affairs of many of the prison staff, including its corrupt governor. In return, Andy is allowed to have his own cell, is protected from the violent prison gang known as the Sisters, and is permitted to open a prison library where he helps other inmates read, write, and study. However, his work for the prison governor, who earns huge sums by hiring out prisoners as cheap labour, makes Andy too useful to be allowed to go free. So, when evidence emerges that could prove Andy's innocence, the governor ensures that neither it nor Andy will see the light of day.
Andy was in for murdering his wife and her lover. As I believe I have said, everyone in prison is an innocent man. Oh, they read that scripture the way those holy rollers on TV read the Book of Revelations. They were the victims of judges with hearts of stone and balls to match, or incompetent lawyers, or police frame-ups, or bad luck. They read the scripture, but you can see a different scripture in their faces. Most cons are a low sort, no good to themselves or anyone else, and their worst luck was that their mothers carried them to term. In all my years at Shawshank, there have been less than 10 men whom I believed when they told me they were innocent. Andy Dufresne was one of them, although I only became convinced of his innocence over a period of years.
I read Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption in a single sitting. Red's calm retelling of the sometimes brutal events that he witnesses made me suspect that Stephen King had done some pretty thorough research into prison life in post-war America. While some of the language and scenes it describes might not appeal to all readers, this is far from a grim read. The story's subtitle is Hope Springs Eternal, and hope is very much the central theme. Whether it's supplied by the small luxuries that Red procures for his fellow prisoners to make their lives more bearable, or the distant prospect of parole, the hope of freedom provides the inner light that allows Andy and Red to survive even the darkest moments of their incarceration. The version of Different Seasons by Stephen King that I downloaded from the RNIB library via Overdrive was TB10543, and it's narrated in a suitably stoical manner by Hayward Morse. The The other stories in the collection are Breathing Method, Apt Pupil, and The Body, which became the film Stand By Me.
In all our lives, there's a fall from innocence, a time after which we are never the same. It happened in the summer of 1959, a long time ago.
Oh, man, where do you hear this? Where do you hear this?
What is it, man?
You guys want to go see a dead body?
When the night has come and the land is dark.
We interrupt to bring you an update on the search for the missing 12-year-old Ray Brower.
Kid's gone. They're never going to find him.
Not where they're looking.
And the moon is the only...
A clip from Stand By Me, based on the Stephen King story The Body, available in the collection Different Seasons, which is TB10543. I read it for the short story Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption, and some other classic titles about prisons or imprisonment that are available from the RNIB library include The Prisoner of Zenda by Anthony Hope, which is TB13035. The Colditz Story by Major P.R. Reed, which is TB2020. Papillon by Henri Charrière, which is his gripping account of his imprisonment and escape from Devil's Island, which is TB1371. And all three volumes of A Prison Diary, Geoffrey Archer's account of his time inside. For more information, visit the website rniblibrary.com or contact the helpline on 0303 123 9999. Have you found a hidden gem in the library? Or maybe you've got a book that you think would expand my reading horizons? Drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
This is an RNIB talking book.
My dad, bless him, is losing his sight quite rapidly at the moment. He's got macular degeneration and is registered blind now.
Author Jonathan Mears on supporting talking books.
And I know that he is becoming increasingly dependent on talking books. He cannot speak highly enough of the RNIB and everything they do, and they've been an absolute godsend to my own dad.
For more information on the Talking Book service, head to www.rnib.org.uk or call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Now, following the publication of the shortlist for this year's Man Booker Prize, we thought it a good idea to revisit some of the titles in the running for that prestigious prize from previous years. Back in 2010, one of the titles in contention was Emma Donoghue's moving tale of imprisonment, Room. James Butterworth wanted to find out more.
Jack and Ma live in a locked room that measures 11 foot by 11. When he turns 5, he starts to ask questions and his mother reveals to him that there is a world outside. Told entirely in Jack's voice, Room is no horror story or tearjerker, but a celebration of resilience and the love between parent and child. And the author, Emma Donoghue, joins me on the line now. And where are we speaking to you from?
I'm at home in London, Ontario, in Canada, where I live. I used to live in England for 8 years, in Cambridge, and then I spent my first 20 years in Ireland. So like many Irish people, I've emigrated several times.
So tell us, Emma, what first prompted you to write the novel Room?
You know, it happened to be hearing headlines about the Fritzl case in Austria that triggered it. But what I immediately jumped on was the notion of a small child relating his first encounter with a world that he didn't even really know was there. So I loved the idea of a child growing up completely cut off from the world in one room, in incredible isolation, but with an absolutely wonderful mother who manages to give him just about everything he needs. So it's kind of a test case for child development and for human happiness. You know, the question is, could you be happy if you had everything except for your freedom?
So the story is told entirely from the perspective of Jack, the five-year-old boy. Did the fact that you had children of a similar age influence that decision? Was that part of the thinking process when you first decided to write this novel?
That wasn't why I made Jack five. I think it's that because the youngest of the Fritzl children, Felix Fritzl, was five, I just thought about that age and what a perfect moment it was, because a five-year-old narrator can speak in complete sentences as a three-year-old can't, but they're not as worldly as even an eight-year-old would be. They still have that truly wacky point of view on things. And certainly my children, they were four and one when I first got the idea, but my son was five by the time I was writing it, so it was a perfect coincidence, really, that I absolutely love the way five-year-olds will speak about quite abstract issues like, you know, God and the afterlife and reincarnation, and then the very next minute they're back to, you know, how many peas do I have to eat and when will there be pizza? So I knew that with a five-year-old narrator I could deal with very big subjects without the book ever becoming pompous.
And so did your son help you with your research in trying to work out how five-year-olds think and speak?
He did. I mean, I mostly just observed him talking and playing and so on. But at one point, for a kind of a crunch moment in the plot, I said to him, Finn, is there any chance I could roll you up in this rug and you have to try and wriggle your way out? And he's always game for an adventure. So he did. And it was extremely difficult. And he had a bit of a panic in there in the rug. But I'm afraid I was ruthless. I kept saying, try harder. Put your hands out the end. Try harder. So, in fact, it transformed the scene. I had to go back and rewrite it completely. So I owe him a few royalties for this one.
He'll hold you to that. Describe the process of writing Room then. So you're perhaps better known for your historical novels. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I've always written both contemporary and historical, but until now I've reached more readers with my historicals. And oddly enough, researching Room was quite like writing a historical novel, because I was trying to conjure up a very vivid little world which is natural to the people living in it, you know, Ma and Jack enclosed in the room, but is very strange to the reader. So it's much like that if you set out to write about, say, 18th century working class London. So that experience of creating a foreign little world, but one that comes to feel natural to the reader, was very, very useful. But I also thought of Room as almost like science fiction at times, you know, because the boy is like somebody from another planet in a way. He comes to our world, but with very few preconceptions, and everything's rather strange to him. So I never thought of this as a kind of a true crime book. Although it has suspenseful elements, I really wanted it to be the kind of novel that would make people think about their world, you know. So it was never just about the kidnapping situation. But I think what makes a novel hard to write is when the technique is not going well, you know, when you feel stuck or uncertain about your subject. But in this case, the entire story and perspective and tone of Room came to me really all in one go as I was driving along a highway. It was one of those inspiration experiences that writers very rarely have in such a complete way. So I always knew what I wanted to say in Room, and I absolutely trusted my five-year-old narrator, and I knew that if I sort of put myself in his hands, a lot of interesting things would come up. And so it was bliss to write, especially as it's more suspenseful than my books usually are. That provided a real kind of impetus under my wheels, you know.
Old Nick is the tormentor and kidnapper, and you choose not to really divulge his backstory. I mean, what was the thinking behind that?
I very deliberately didn't give him a backstory because I'm sick of abusers saying it's all because I had a bad childhood. You know, plenty of people have bad childhoods and it doesn't make them into monsters. So I tried to make him a very realistic kind of everyday psychopath in that he's not particularly cruel. He doesn't have particularly freakish mannerisms. It's just that he wants the convenience of having a girl locked up in his backyard instead of having a normal human relationship. So I tried to make him an example of the banality of evil. And yes, I don't even give him a name. He's just known by his nickname, Old Nick. And in a way, I tried to punish him even within the book by showing that, you know, what was originally a sexual thrill to him, kidnapping this girl, has actually, hardened into a very dull domestic situation. He's stuck with this girl and her child in the shed, and he has to, you know, bring groceries and do minor repairs. So, you know, it's so not a book about a kind of a sexy kidnapping victim scenario, Stockholm Syndrome. I tried to avoid all those cliches and really make it a book about a childhood rather than a book about a kidnapping.
The subject matter is dark, but this isn't a horror story. You're able to bring in humour. Was that important to you?
Yes, it is. I bring humour into everything I write because I just don't know any way to communicate without it. And I think humour is particularly helpful when you're dealing with something really dark. Because, I mean, who wants to immerse themselves in a nightmare world? You have to lure them in. And I knew that a five-year-old narrator would bring plenty of humour and naivety to his recounting of his days. And above all, I wanted it to read like quite a universal story. I mean, the circumstances are peculiar, but the interaction between mother and child is based at every point on interactions that I've had with my kids. You know, some of the things Jack needs to learn at five, my kids probably learned at two because they've had a very social upbringing. But it's all the same human pattern of a parent trying to look after their child and trying to figure out at what point the child needs freedom more than needing protection.
As a successful author, just tell me what reading means to you.
I could not live without reading myself. And in fact, even though my eyes work just grand, I've always thought if I had eye trouble, could I get enough books in various forms? It would be just crucial to me. It's oxygen to me. And I often meet parents who say, oh, I've had no time to read since the children. And I think, well, I must prefer books to my children sometimes because I always make time to read. I find it nourishes me and puts ideas in my head that I would never have otherwise. And also, I've never lived in a big city and hung out with other writers in a sort of salon way. I've always felt I've taken part in the kind of international confraternity of writers through reading their books and they read my books, you know. So it's a form of human interaction which is just as important to me as actual face-to-face meetings. And there's no pleasure like it and no escape like it as well.
And so to you, I mean, why do you think the Talking Book service is so important then?
I think it's funny, I've never made a fetish of the book as a physical object because I don't care whether people read my books on e-readers or in audio or, serialized on the radio or on paper. What matters is the words and the story. I think that's the important thing. You know, with all the technological changes about how books are accessed, I don't think we need worry. The important thing is that words get into people's minds. So the Talking Book service as a way of producing books in formats which will be easier for people who are visually impaired, I think it must be an absolute lifeline. You know, I very often read to my children before they're able to read, and my children take such a full part in literature, even though it's somebody else reading it to them. So I think the Talking Book service must be a way of getting books to people who just wouldn't be able to access them otherwise, and it should be celebrated and supported.
Emma Donoghue, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks to James and to Emma Donoghue. Room and a wide selection of her other titles are available from the RNIB library, where, thanks to a long-standing agreement between RNIB and the Booker Foundation, members can find all the shortlisted titles from this and previous years in giant print, braille and audiobook versions, enabling us to join in the conversation about who this year's winner should be. Another author who's written about false imprisonment is Kate Hamer. Her debut novel, The Girl in the Red Coat, is a tense psychological thriller about an 8-year-old child who is abducted from a storytelling festival and then held captive by a man who believes that she has special powers. You can hear Kate talking about that and her latest book, The Doll Funeral, on our Audio Boom page, but here she picks three books that have resonated with her, one from childhood, a rainy day book, and a book that she's read recently that she wants us to read. And although she was tempted to pick Grimm's Fairy Tales, she decided to go for some happier reading.
I'd probably start with the book from my childhood. Maybe not the fairy tales, even. It's the beginning of Treasure Island, and I used to read it over and over and over again because it's just like a masterclass in atmosphere, I would say. It's the bit with the Admiral Benbow and the black spot and the fog, and it's actually quite a short scene. In my memory, it kind of goes through like a real slow motion thing. But I reread it recently, and it's actually quite short. So I used to read that over and over and over again, and by the time it comes to the sea voyage in the novel, I've always lost interest and abandoned it. It was just that wonderful, wonderful opening. So that is perhaps the one I would choose as my early influence.
It was one January morning, very early, a pinching, frosty morning. The cove, all grey with hoarfrost, the ripple lapping softly on the stones, the sun still low and only touching the hilltops and shining far to seaward. The captain had risen earlier than usual and set out down the beach, his cutlass swinging under the broad skirts of the old blue coat, his brass telescope under his arm, his hat tilted back upon his head. I remember his breath hanging like smoke in his wake as he strode off, and the last sound I heard of him as he turned the big rock was a loud snort of indignation, as though his mind was still running upon Dr. Livesey. Well, Mother was upstairs with Father, and I was laying the breakfast table against the captain's return, when the parlour door opened and a man stepped in, on whom I'd never set my eyes before. He was a pale, tallowy creature, wanting two fingers of the left hand, and though he wore a cutlass, he did not look much like a fighter. I'd always my eye open for seafaring men, with one leg or two. And I remember this one puzzled me. He was not sailorly, and yet he had a smack of the sea about him, too. I asked him what was for his service, and he said he would take rum. But as I was going out of the room to fetch it, he sat down upon a table and motioned me to draw near. I paused where I was, with my napkin in my hand. "Come here, sonny," says he. "Come nearer here." I took a step nearer. "Is this here table for my mate Bill?" he asked with a kind of leer. I told him I did not know his mate Bill, and this was for a person who stayed in our house, whom we call the captain. "Well," said he, "my mate Bill would be called the captain, as like as not. He has a cut on one cheek, and a mighty pleasant way with him, particularly in drink. As my mate Bill, we'll put it for argument like that your captain has a cut on one cheek, and we'll put it if you like that that cheek's the right one." "Ah, well, I told you. Now is my mate Bill in this here house?" I told him he was out walking. "Which way, sonny? Which way is he gone?"
A book to curl up with on a rainy day has to be Cold Comfort Farm by Stella Gibbons, which is just, even now, even just thinking about it just makes me smile. And I love the whole premise of Flora Post, or Post, I'm not quite sure which it is, coming down to the countryside and encountering her distant cousins, the Starkadders, in, I think, a place called Little Howling in Sussex, I think. And just one by one sorting them out. And, you know, she's so practical. And it's just a delight. It's just such a delightful book that just, I don't know, is so life-affirming. And I just love the fact that even Aunt Ada Doom, who hasn't been out of her room for like 40 years, manages to rule her family with a rod of iron without even stepping out her bedroom door. Flora even manages to sort her out. And then I think she ends up sending her off on a flying course or something like that. Anyway, that would be my rainy day book. It's just wonderful.
Mrs. Smiling was awaiting her in the drawing room overlooking the river. She was a small Irish woman of 26 years, with a fair complexion, large grey eyes, and a little crooked nose. She had two interests in life. One was the imposing of reason and moderation into the bosoms of some 15 gentlemen of birth and fortune who were madly in love with her, and who had flown to such remote places as the Jong Song La, Lake Maluba Maluba, and the Kwanhattans because of her refusal to marry them. She wrote to them all once a week, and they, as her friends knew to their cost, for she was forever reading aloud long, boring bits from their letters, they wrote to her. These gentlemen, because of the hard work they did in savage foreign parts and of their devotion to Mrs. Smiling, were known collectively as Mary's Pioneers, O, a quotation from the spirited poem by Walt Whitman. Mrs. Smiling's second interest was her collection of brassieres and her search for a perfect one. She was reputed to have the largest and finest collection of these garments in the world. It was hoped that on her death it would be left to the nation. She was an authority on the cut, fit, colour, construction and proper functioning of brassieres, and her friends had learned that her interest, even in moments of extreme emotional or physical distress, could be aroused and her composure restored by the hasty utterance of the phrase, "I saw a brassiere today, Mary, that would have interested you."
A book that I've been bowled over by recently is a book called Witchlight by Susan Fletcher, and it's just beautifully written. It's based around the Glencoe massacres and based around the figure that's, I think, kind of gone down into folklore that she became very interested in, which was quite an ethereal character, but who is believed to have warned the people of the valley that this massacre was about to take place, and meant that some of them actually managed to get away and save their lives. But she'd actually been persecuted as a witch, and it's just a very extraordinarily well-told and beautifully written book. So that's quite a recent find.
Thanks to Kate. Her book, The Girl in the Red Coat, is available as TB23714. And don't forget, if you'd like to share the books of your life, you can do so by emailing the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. So that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch about your book groups, the titles you've been enjoying, and your ideas for books that I should read. Read On Air will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and author interviews. Simply go to audioboom.com and search for RNIB, where you'll find Read On Air and other great content from RNIB Connect Radio. So, until next week, thanks for listening, and remember to read on.